A Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Okay, let's unpack this. We're diving into the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
For so many of us, it's just this hugely influential, but also maybe intimidating stack of writings in Western culture.
Right.
Maybe you feel a bit overwhelmed by it or, you know, frustrated by really simple readings that just miss the depth, the history.
Yeah, the context gets lost.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So today we've got these sources and they're centered around the work of John Riches. And they really offer, well, kind of a shortcut to genuine biblical literacy.
And what's so interesting right off the bat is how Riches challenges that basic assumption we bring to it.
Which is?
Well, we're taught to think the book, singular. Riches says, no, think ta Biblia.
The Greek for.
The books.
Precisely. A library. Vast, complex. And our mission here really is to get a handle on the human element, you know, the historical choices, the political pressures, the theological decisions that actually built this library. And understanding that human origin, it doesn't diminish it.
Quite the opposite. Riches argues it actually enriches its significance.
Okay. So this is for anyone, really.
Yeah.
Whether you're coming at the Bible culturally, academically, spiritually, this is about getting the tools to navigate that complexity without getting sort of stuck in the usual traps.
And Riches is a great guide for that. John Riches, he's Professor Emeritus of Divinity and Biblical Criticism at the University of Glasgow.
Right.
He's got this unique combination, deep, rigorous academic criticism, you know, the really intense historical analysis, but also this ability to make it accessible, to communicate it clearly to a wider audience. He helps us dig, basically.
In that digging, that historical approach, that's the core of it.
It really is. Riches asks us to treat the Bible like a historical document, apply the same analytical tools you'd use for Plato or, I don't know, Cicero.
That feels like a key move. It lets you step away from maybe a defensive literalism on one side.
Right.
And also a kind of dismissive secular view on the other. You can respect its importance without glossing over the history.
Exactly. And the big shift in perspective he demands is seeing it as an anthology, a collection.
Not written all at once.
Not at all. Writings from different communities across maybe 1,000 years, reflecting all sorts of different contexts, styles, theologies. That diversity isn't a mistake. It's a feature.
Okay, so if we run with that library idea, it gets complicated fast.
Mm-hmm.
Because which library are we even talking about?
Huh. Good question. The Bible isn't just one fixed thing. The actual shape of the collection changes depending on the tradition.
Right.
Take the Old Testament. You, the listener, might have one of three different versions. There's the Jewish Tanakh, the foundation. It's got the Torah, the law, the Nevi'im, the prophets, and the Ketuvim, the writings. Three main sections. That's the core.
But then in Christianity, the Protestant Old Testament takes those same books, basically, rearranges them, and counts 39. But then, if you grab a Catholic Bible, it's got those 39-plus extra books. Tobit, Judith, Wisdom of Solomon. They call them deuterocanonical.
That's right. And this points us straight to canonization, how the list got decided.
And Riches says this wasn't like a neat, tidy event.
Far from it. Not some sudden divine announcement. It was, well, messy. Spans centuries. A very human process.
Driven by what?
Often, Riches argues, by external pressures and internally by this deep need for a community to figure out who they were, to unify their identity, especially when they felt threatened.
It's kind of wild to think the list of books itself is a historical artifact shaped by conflict.
Absolutely. And there's a fantastic, almost ironic example, Marcion of Sinope, 2nd century CE.
Okay, what did he do?
He was a major Christian leader who looked at the entire Old Testament and basically said, nope, reject it all.
The whole thing, why?
He thought the God of the Old Testament was like an inferior, angry deity, totally separate from the loving God Jesus talked about.
Wow, so what did he use?
He made his own Bible, the first known official Christian canon, actually, but it was tiny. Just a heavily edited version of Luke's gospel and 10 of Paul's letters. He threw out everything else.
That's radical.
Totally. And this act, which the mainstream church called heresy, it actually forced their hand. It acted like a catalyst. It pushed the wider church to say, okay, wait, we need to define our authoritative texts.
So the heretic actually sped up the process of the mainstream church defining its own Bible. That is ironic.
Massively ironic. Marcion's rejection helped push the church towards settling the 27-book New Testament we know today and solidifying the idea that, yes, the Old Testament does belong alongside the New.
So the canon itself is like a snapshot of a community working out its identity under pressure.
Perfectly put. And even once you have the list, you look inside and the variety is just staggering. You've got law codes right next to really personal poetry. Wow. You've got history, then these like wild apocalyptic visions, personal letters, long sermons.
So you can't just read it all the same way.
Absolutely not. Different genres demand different reading glasses, essentially. You don't read, say, the Book of Numbers like you read the Gospel of John.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
And if they were collected over time, we need to think about how they were put together, right? The construction process.
Yes. Riches points out these texts are often composite. They didn't just appear fully formed.
They came from oral traditions first.
Rich oral traditions, yeah. And then later, editors, scribes wove these traditions together.
Is there a key moment for that happening, especially for the Old Testament?
The sources often point to the Babylonian exile, 6th century BCE. That was a huge trauma.
Right. The temple destroyed, people deported.
Exactly. Their physical center was gone. Their identity felt like it was dissolving.
So if they couldn't gather in Jerusalem anymore, they needed something else to hold on to.
Precisely. A portable identity. The exile created this urgent need. Preserve the stories, the laws, the history, put it in writing, or risk disappearing altogether.
So that crisis might be when the idea of the Bible as a fixed authoritative text really started to take shape.
Arguably, yes. And this leads us to a really helpful tool Riches talks about, redaction criticism.
Okay, redaction, like editing.
Essentially, yeah. It's analyzing how the final author, editor, the redactor, took earlier bits of material, maybe oral stories, maybe other writings, and shaped them, arranged them, maybe tweaked them a bit to fit their specific theological message or purpose.
So we're like text detectives looking for the editor's fingerprints.
That's a great way to put it. Mm-hmm. We're asking, how did the final editor frame this? What choices did they make?
Is there a clear example?
The classic one Riches uses is looking at the Gospels of Matthew and Luke.
Okay.
We know they both used Mark's Gospel, which was earlier, and probably another shared source of Jesus' sayings called Q.
Right.
But look at how they edit Mark. Matthew, for example, writing for a largely Jewish Christian audience, keeps shaping the narrative to present Jesus as the new Moses. Mm-hmm. He emphasizes fulfillment of prophecy, Jewish lineage.
He's making a specific argument for his audience.
Exactly. Whereas Luke, writing more for Gentiles, edits some of the same stories to highlight, say, universal compassion or the work of the Holy Spirit. Same source material, different editorial angle.
Wow. Okay, that changes how you see it. It means when we talk about traditional authorship, like Moses wrote the first five books or Isaiah wrote all of Isaiah, it's more complex. It's like historical memory mixed with later theological reflection.
That's a very good way to describe it. The final text often has layers from different times woven together, and a critical reading can sometimes spot those seams.
So if the text is this layered, edited collection, what does that mean for us reading it now? How do we find meaning?
Well, Riches is very clear. Interpretation is unavoidable. There's no such thing as just reading it purely.
Meaning happens in the encounter.
Exactly. Between the text and the reader or the community reading it, it's dynamic.
But does that mean anything goes? Are there any boundaries Riches suggests?
Oh, absolutely. Contextual boundaries are key. Always start by asking, what did this likely mean to the original audience in their world?
The ancient Near Eastern world or Greco-Roman world?
Right. Understand that first. Only then can you start thinking about how it might speak today. And this whole idea is powerfully illustrated by translation.
Because translation is never neutral.
Never. It's always an act of interpretation. Think about St. Jerome back in the 4th century. His Latin Vulgate translation became the Bible for Western Europe for over 1,000 years.
And he made a big choice with the Old Testament, right?
Huge choice. The common version then was a Greek translation, the Septuagint. Jerome rejected that for the Old Testament and went back to the original Hebrew, the Hebraica Veritas. He called it the Hebrew truth. That caused a massive stir.
And fast forward centuries later, people like William Tyndale.
Tyndale. Mm. Translating the Bible into English in the 16th century, that wasn't just scholarly work. It was a revolutionary political act.
Because it made it accessible to ordinary people, took control away from the church hierarchy.
Precisely. And he paid for it with his life. strangled and burned for translating.
It really shows how much power is tied up in who gets to translate and interpret.
And translation choices have massive theological consequences. The famous example, Isaiah 7.14, the Hebrew word alma means young woman.
Okay.
The Greek Septuagint translated it as Parthenos, which specifically means virgin. When New Testament writers like Matthew later quoted that verse referring to Mary, they used the Greek version. That translation choice had enormous impact.
Yeah, you can see that. And this leads to another tough point Riches raises, the Bible's dualistic legacy.
Yes, he presents this very impartially. The same book, the same texts have been used throughout history to justify completely opposite things.
That's crucial to acknowledge.
Its power, in a way, lies in its adaptability, for good and sometimes for ill.
We can't ignore that difficult history. The Exodus story, for instance, a powerful narrative of liberation that inspired abolitionists, civil rights leaders, liberation theology.
Mm-hmm. A core text for freedom movements.
But at the same time, defenders of slavery in the American South were pointing to other passages, like in Ephesians, slaves, obey your masters, to justify the system.
It's stark. It shows the text itself doesn't really police how it's used. The meaning gets forged by the reader, the community, and their agenda.
Riches insists we have to face that complex reality for any responsible engagement today.
Definitely.
Okay, so let's try to pull this together. We've got the library idea, the messy canon process, the editing. What are, say, the top three takeaways Riches offers us as modern readers or learners?
Okay, three key things. First, context is king, always. You have to grapple with the ancient world socially, politically, culturally before you jump to applying it now. Historical literacy first.
Got it. Number two.
Second, literary appreciation. Read it as literature, too. Notice the poetry, the storytelling craft, the symbolism. Riches argues this doesn't weaken its theological punch. It actually deepens it. Form and content work together.
Okay, context, literary appreciation. Third,
rethink the nature of sacredness. For Riches, the Bible's authority doesn't necessarily rest on being factually inerrant or scientifically accurate in a modern sense.
But rather.
Rather, its power, its sacred quality, lies in its persistent ability over centuries to spark new insights, to challenge us, to provide a shared language and framework for communities wrestling with big questions. It's about its function.
Its function within the human story, that makes sense. And there's a broader skill here too, isn't there?
Absolutely. The ultimate application is critical thinking.
How so?
If you learn how to analyze the Bible like this, asking about sources, context, editorial agendas, audience, you develop a powerful toolkit.
A toolkit you can use anywhere.
Exactly. Reading the news, listening to a political speech, looking at an advertisement. You're equipped to ask, who created this message? For whom and why? What's their angle?
It trains your critical eye.
It really does. Which leads to Rich's final point, maybe a provocation.
Okay.
He suggests the Bible stays relevant not because it gives easy, simple answers. No. But because it honestly records humanity's ongoing, often messy, struggle with the biggest questions. What is justice? Why is there suffering? What about transcendence? It wrestles with them.
So we'll leave you with this to think about. If the Bible's sacredness, as Riches suggests, is partly found in its function within a community, the dialogue it starts, the identity it helps shape, what does that make us think about other texts today? Maybe secular texts that we treat with a kind of similar weight. Perhaps things like national constitutions or foundational economic theories.
Are we treating some modern texts with a kind of functional sacredness, shaping our communities and dialogues in similar ways?
Something to mull over.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.